Welcome to Health Cetera's podcast. Palliative care is a branch of medical care that is focused on providing relief from the symptoms and stress of an illness. Oftentimes, patients requiring palliative care services are battling serious chronic diseases and may even be transitioning into an end-of-life period. A major component of improving quality of life for these patients is pain management, which may require the usage of prescription opioids. However, recent legislation enacted to curb the opioid epidemic may complicate the pain management process. On this podcast, Diana Mason, registered nurse and host of this program, invites Katie Fitzgerald Jones, a palliative care and addiction nurse practitioner, for a conversation about the difficulties that both patients and their providers navigate and managing chronic and terminal pain with rigid opioid restrictions in place. This podcast first aired on Health Cetera in the Catskills on WIOX Radio on December 15th, 2021.
Well, I'm a huge proponent of palliative care, which is the management of symptoms, including pain. Now, often a palliative care team or specialist is called in for people with terminal illnesses, but it should be a part of care for anyone with difficult or disabling conditions from a disease or a condition, particularly one that's chronic or one that's terminal. Palliative care nurses and physicians are usually the experts in pain management, and most people don't realize this. But best practice in pain management are complicated by the opioid epidemic, by people, if when somebody has a history of opioid use, that can complicate the picture, or for people who do have terminal illnesses or who are on opioids for pain management for a long time, how to manage the withdrawal from that drug. Katie Fitzgerald Jones is a palliative care and addiction nurse practitioner. She's a doctoral candidate at Boston College, and she's been pushing for improving palliative care practices for quite some time. And I just discovered that this is an issue that she cares deeply about. And Katie, thank you so much for coming on to Health Cetera in the Catskills today.
Thank you for having me, Diana.
So let's start with talking about what palliative care is. Some people equate it with hospice, but it's not. So what is it, and when should somebody ask for a referral to palliative care?
You said it pretty well. Palliative care is really both a philosophy of care and a specialty care service that focuses on maximizing quality of life and minimizing suffering. And really, it should be indicated if the patient wants it or needs it. And one thing that really drew me to palliative care was that as a nurse practitioner, the definitions of palliative care in terms of whole person care and alleviating suffering, humanizing the experience, are really the tenets of what I see my role as a nurse is.
Yes. In fact, I would hold that the tenets of palliative care should apply throughout healthcare.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So the current opioid epidemic really has complicated the picture in certain ways for palliative care providers. What are your thoughts about some of the challenges that the opioid epidemic is presenting to those who are working in this space?
So, I've been practicing palliative care for about 15 years. And during that time, it's really shifted, and we're an early field, and again, I think kind of evolved out of a nursing and the hospice movement, but palliative care can be offered to anybody along the illness trajectory. But I think what we are now seeing in the context of rising rates of opioid overdoses is both a better attention to opioid safety, and developing some skills to treat people that have a history of chronic pain and opioid use disorder or another substance use disorder. And this is something I see you know, I take really seriously because we are at, you know, the peak of the overdose crisis right now with 93,000 lives lost in this last year. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think, again, if you go back to the goal of palliative care, it's really to alleviate suffering. And I think for a long time what I was seeing in my practice is addiction was one of those sufferings that suffering that we were ignoring in our field. And I think we really need to do better. So I think what I've been seeing in my practice is that we're developing these skills to care for people that develop an opioid use. Either they come into their serious illness with a substance use or opioid use disorder, they develop it during the stressful time of their serious illness, or they finish a diagnosis and treatment of a condition such as cancer, and then they're sort of left needing treatment for a substance use disorder that they acquired during the course of the difficulties managing, say, cancer pain.
So there's three buckets here that I think I want to drill down on a little bit more. One is just being able to adequately medicate patients who, during these days when there is so much monitoring now of opioid prescribing. Second is people who you're treating with opioid use disorder to begin with when they walk in. And the third is people who develop a dependence and while they're getting their pain managed. So let's start with the access issue. Do you face a lot of problems with prescribing opioids to people? I think particularly about people who are terminally ill. You know, if I'm terminally ill, just give me whatever I need to get me out of pain or to make me comfortable according to what I want at a comfort level. And I've become worried if I become terminally ill, will I have access to enough medication to manage my pain the way I want to manage it?
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, I think in the context of the overdose crisis, what we have also seen in the last decade is research on the benefits and harms of opioid therapy really exploding. Mm-hmm. And these are in instances of non-cancer pain. But, you know, there's a big list of harms, and there's mm-hmm. also benefits. And I know anecdotally, we often speak to examples where opioids have really helped alleviate suffering and help the pain. And so I think when you're thinking about somebody at the end of life, you know, those harms become less important.
Yeah.
And the benefits often outweigh the harms. And yet, I don't think that we have policies that are nuanced enough to really overcome some of that. And so what we are left with are these access challenges. For example, 36 laws, states have instituted opioid laws to say that, you know, you may only be able to get a 3-day supply with an initial prescription or a 5-day or 7-day. And I just actually completed an article that's going out this week around this, but some of those states have palliative care and end-of-life exemptions, and some of them don't.
Wow.
And that's a real problem.
Yeah.
And I think our effort to curb opioid prescribing has really come at a detriment to people with pain. And there's been really this drift that affects people with cancer and affects people with chronic pain and affects people at the end of life.
Yeah, you know, it is trying to find the balance, isn't it? I had a dental procedure, and the dentist was going to prescribe a week of opioids for me. I said, no, give me enough for 24 hours. If I'm having that level of pain after 24 hours, I probably need to see you again. And so I don't want more than I need, and I don't like them anyway. I feel like they just sort of numb you, but without totally getting rid of the pain. So I think there is that piece that providers were starting to look more deeply in what works for pain management other than opioids, and how do opioids work best and for whom. So I feel like there's so much nuance to that discussion that we're still trying to uncover. But your point about some of these states now making it so hard for people who really do, if they have a terminal illness, you don't want to have to be going every 3 days for a new prescription and to go to the pharmacy, et cetera. You just don't. So I'm glad to hear some states have exemptions for palliative care prescribers. I'm concerned that not all states do. So that's something we have to keep our eye on. And are you feeling more or less pressure as somebody who does prescribe opioids? Do you feel more or less pressure from patients to have opioids for management of pain?
I mean, it sort of depends. I don't necessarily feel pressure from patients. I think I feel institutional pressure, to be responsible about prescribing. But again, how responsible is defined is sort of an arbitrary metric. And so I think, like, as a nurse practitioner, for example, and somebody that, you know, does this as a specialty, you know, I have lots of people I'm prescribing opioids for, often at high doses with other comorbidities. And so it looks like I'm an at-risk prescriber. Mm. But I think of myself as a pretty responsible, evidence-based clinician. And so I think sometimes these metrics are a bit misleading in terms of how people are prescribing. But I think, and, you know, there are patients that I think feel scared that their opioids will be taken away from them when they've been stable on opioids for chronic pain. And I think that's really hard. And I think, you know, one thing I think a lot about is that our opioid policies aren't really a zero-sum game. You know, they're actually punishing everybody. Yeah. They're punishing people with pain. They're punishing people with addiction. They're really punishing people at this intersection. And even people with chronic pain on long-term opioids, a colleague did a study and 40% of, they did a secret shopper study and they said they had chronic pain, they were on long-term opioids, and 40% of primary care doctors or clinicians weren't taking them as patients. Wow. Just by nature of being on opioids. And so the opioids themselves are stigmatized, the patients with chronic pain and patients with addiction, of course. Mm.
That's very disturbing to hear. Wow, that you may not even be able to get a provider if you need one. So if we move to the second, actually, it's the third bucket I want to move to, that I've had personal experience. Some people know that my husband has had some health issues that required surgery. And he's an older man. He doesn't take medication. At one point I said, you know, earlier on in his life that, you know, an aspirin made him high. So he doesn't take, he's very medication naive in many ways, and particularly pain medication. And so after the surgery, and it was painful surgery, I go in and he's on opioids, a healthy dose of opioids every 4 hours. And he was so snowed. I said, you know, I think he's over-medicated. Can we not do PRN as necessary, because you want to manage that pain up front and not let the pain get ahead of you? And I said, but could we, you know, alternate it with Tylenol or with something else? And so I finally got them to taper the medication back a bit. But when we were leaving, no one talked with us. He had a 30-day supply of opioids. Now, this was, I think, 4 or 5 years ago. And nobody talked with us or with him about how to taper off the opioids. Now, I knew enough to know that if he kept taking these opioids every 4 hours for a month, he would be dependent upon them, and it would be really hard to get off of them. So I started to taper him and alternated with Tylenol. In the end, he did have a hard time giving up the opioid at night. And I said, you're going to have an uncomfortable night. You might as well do it now. It wasn't from pain. It was that he wouldn't sleep well, he said. So I have concerns about the extent to which healthcare providers, even outside of palliative care, are preparing patients for how do you want to think about this drug that's a powerful drug and taper it. Do you hear more conversations going on among healthcare providers about we've got to do a better job of telling people how to taper off of this drug?
And these are the conversations we should be having. I think they're happening in pockets, particularly in chronic pain, but I think there's really a missed opportunity in situations where you're describing acute pain. And I agree, this happens all the time. My dad's a head and neck cancer survivor, and he was on opioids for about a year during his treatment. And same on, you know, healthy doses, as you say. And, you know, it was just this assumption that he would just stop. But it was actually much harder than that. Not because he, you know, because it was just, he didn't have any guidance. He wasn't sure what was normal. He wasn't sure what he should tolerate, mm-hmm. what's a sign that things aren't going well. And I think it's really a reflection of our training in general. We spend all this time thinking about how and when to initiate medication, yes. but very little time on how to stop them or when it's time to try a different approach. Mm-hmm. And something we see a lot in chronic pain and opioid tapering is that it can be hard for people to tolerate. It can be destabilizing for mental health conditions. It can exacerbate a substance use disorder. Mm-hmm. In the last few years, the Health and Human Services put out some recommendations around opioid tapering and how to actually do it, but they're not evidence-based, and I frequently have to stray from them because a patient, for example, you know, just is like, I'm going too fast, this isn't working for me. But it's a real problem because even if you don't want to be on opioids, there's this kind of phenomenon where opioids beget opioids. And some of the CDC data, one opioid prescription, 20% will remain on opioids for a year.
What percent?
20%.
Wow. Unprescribed fentanyl.
And if you have a 90-day prescription, 60% of people will remain on them for 2 years.
Wow.
And again, this is a little bit old data in the last 3 years, but I think it speaks to what you're saying, which is we spend so much time thinking about, you know, who should get opioids, but then not enough time thinking about how to help people stop them or when they're no longer needed. And I think what I see a lot in my practice, particularly with cancer survivors, is that there's a lot of inertia, both patients, I think, because they've just been through, you know, the world's hardest thing, and you know, clinicians, because it takes a lot of time and energy and a lot of support to facilitate this process. And so I think we get sort of inertia about it.
Now, one of the concerns I know you have that I share is that if somebody does become addicted while they're being treated for pain management, for pain from a condition, and by the way, the fentanyl that's prescribed is not as strong as the fentanyl that we're now seeing on the street, and it's that is contaminating drugs of all sorts, street drugs, including now is being laced in with marijuana, and this is what people are overdosing from, that street fentanyl. It's made not at the pharmaceutical company, usually. And the one that's being prescribed is not as strong as what you're seeing on the street by and large. And so the concern is if you're tapering somebody, so I've been seeing you, but now I'm at home and I still am on the opioids and I go to my primary care provider. And I'm concerned, and maybe my provider is concerned, but if there has been a requirement in the past that anybody who, if my provider thinks that I need to be prescribed buprenorphine or some other medication-assisted treatment to help me withdraw from the opioid, there's a concern about who can prescribe that. And it used to be that you had to be certified to prescribe it. Where are we at with that?
Sure. So buprenorphine is a partial opioid agonist, and so it concretely what that means is that the way that it works, it doesn't promote overdose in the same way as full agonists like oxycodone or illicit fentanyl, as you're describing. And so it's a safer opioid. It's both a treatment for pain and for opioid use disorder, and it can help facilitate opioid tapering. For buprenorphine naloxone, the product that is most commonly used to treat opioid use disorder, to treat opioid use disorder, you still need a DEA-X waiver. Since April, you no longer need to complete the education requirement to treat less than 30 patients, which is actually a bit more than the average X waiver clinician is treating, which is around 10 patients. Mm. So for most people, that will be more than sufficient in a standard non-addiction specialty practice. And so the one thing and that's interesting is that in those Health and Human Service guidelines on opioid tapering, if somebody has an opioid use disorder, you need your DEA-X waiver to prescribe buprenorphine. If the person doesn't have an opioid use disorder, you actually do not need an X waiver. And the reason I point that out is it's the same medication, and it just speaks to how backwards the policies are around this, that we have different rules for different conditions, and I think it comes back to how stigmatized addiction is, and that the X waiver sort of sensationalizes what it is to prescribe buprenorphine, which, in my opinion, is far easier than prescribing insulin, is far easier than, you know, titrating a nitro drip.
So, look, in the time that we have left, I want to get your take on two issues. One is, if I am somebody who has had an issue with opioid addiction or opioid use disorder in the past, and I've been in recovery, if I go in for surgery and I take an opioid, I'm going to be really worried. I don't want to go back to being dependent on it. Do you have any advice for me if I'm somebody who has had addictions in the past and now am going to need pain management? What do you advise people to do in that situation? What do you advise the patient to how to approach this with their providers?
So, you know, some recent work has come out that I think is really exciting, because it supports what we've been doing clinically for a long time, which is somebody is on buprenorphine for their opioid use disorder, they take Suboxone, that they can continue that treatment in the preoperative period and in the postoperative period. I think for a long time there was this sort of theoretical belief that it would block the opioids from working. But that has not really borne out clinically, and people actually in the postoperative setting, a lot of data around C-sections, they use less opioids, they have better pain relief, and they're able to be discharged from the hospital sooner. So I think the first thing is, if you're on medication treatment for your opioid use disorder, you know, talk to your prescriber, because it's possible you can continue that medication.
And the idea that a little bit of the opioid may be fine if you go right back on to the medication-assisted treatment, the Suboxone or buprenorphine.
Right, or you never have to stop it at all.
Okay.
You can use them in addition to each other. And this is what I do a lot with cancer pain, is I keep people on buprenorphine and I add a full agonist on top of that, like morphine or oxycodone. So I have their buprenorphine to treat their opioid use disorder, and then I have a full agonist to treat their pain.
Wow. And it doesn't make them sick?
No.
Oh, wow, that's interesting.
No. I think what you're referring to is precipitating withdrawal.
Yes.
If you're starting buprenorphine. But it's a funny thing. It actually only happens when you're starting buprenorphine, not the other way around.
Great. Okay, now... So it's really important for people to have a really open conversation with the anesthesiologist or your surgeon and your care providers about your history, and to work out a plan ahead of time about how you'll manage your pain if you're having a surgical procedure or some short-term procedure. The other question I had was, What advice do you give people who do have pain in terms of interacting with their providers, and particularly if it's chronic pain versus a terminal pain?
Yeah, I think, I think for prescribers, I'd start with just recognizing that, you know, chronic pain is really a biopsychosocial phenomenon, and there are lots of things that are feeding into this experience of pain. So we have to be very open to hearing that. We also have to be very open to treating people with chronic pain with multimodal treatment. And so sometimes that's opioids, sometimes that's not. And so I think if I was a patient with chronic pain, I would also, you know, try to find somebody I trusted that was willing to hear me. I am obviously very biased, but I think nurse practitioners are great at managing the chronic chronic pain, which is a disease in itself. Because I think you really need a therapeutic relationship with somebody, and somebody that is willing to accompany you on this journey. It's hard to live in pain, and it's exhausting. And I think somebody that, you know, you can be open to different things and people that have ideas. And, you know, my favorite people are also pain psychologists, because I think that they can really maximize support for people.
Yeah, and when you say multimodal, you're not just talking about another medication. You're talking about other kinds of approaches to pain management, whether hypnosis, relaxation. I often recommend people consider acupuncture.
And even, you know, some of the pain-related cognitive behavioral therapy and acceptance commitment therapy, so learning to sort of shift your thought. Because pain is, you know, a survival mechanism. So if we're constantly, you know, have an alarm going off in our head, you know, we need to figure out how to turn that noise down.
Well, Katie Fitzgerald-Jones, a palliative care and addiction nurse practitioner, thank you so much for coming on today. This is such an important topic, and I recently had somebody who is in recovery, addiction recovery, who said he was going to probably need to have a procedure done, and he was concerned, and I encouraged him to be very open with his providers about what his history was, and to come up ahead of time with how to manage it and different alternatives to management. But this, I think I'll get back to him and tell him he should listen to the recording of this interview before he goes back to his next visit, and that maybe he can take some opioids while he stays on his medication-assisted treatment. Thank you so much, Katie, for coming on today.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to a podcast of Health Cetera in the Catskills. For more podcasts and discussions of important health issues and policies affecting health, go to Health Cetera's website and blog at www.healthmediapolicy.com. That's www.healthmediapolicy.com. This podcast was produced by Dr. Diana Mason and production assistant Kai Volsey.